Well, I suppose there's only one thing more flattering than having a Dave Dye podcast done about you is to be the Dave Dye in the Dave Dye podcast. This is Paul Burke, and I'm delighted and honoured to have a great friend, a great mentor, a great hero of mine in the studio with me. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Nick Angel. Hello, Nick.
Hello, Paul. Great to be here with you.
Well, in the spirit of these podcasts, Dave always starts, and I'm going to start by, where did it all begin? I know that you're from London, born and bred like me, and I think you, me and Dave are probably the only three people that born in London, work in advertising, still live here. So where'd you start?
Well, I mean, yes, I was born in London, born in Pimlico. I'm very proud of that. And we ended up in Fulham. So, yes, I'm a born and bred Londoner. My dad was a documentary filmmaker. And as a young lad, his office was originally at Shepperton Studios. And so I used to go out there with him. And it was kind of weird because Shepperton Studios, it was like these great big sort of hangar spaces. And they didn't sort of seem particularly inspiring. But I liked looking at the editors at work with the reels of film and what have you. So that was quite intriguing and interesting. But it didn't completely spark my imagination. And it was when I was, I think, about 16. And he had whatever the film was, a documentary film. He was recording a music track for the title sequence of the film. And I went to, I think it was Aquarius Studios, this music studio, to record this music track. And I suddenly thought, my God, this feels so right. This is a place I would like to be. I would love to be in a studio.
But it was the sound and the music rather than the visuals.
Yeah, no, completely. It was completely that. And I guess it was the excitement of looking at a console, just where all the magic happened. And I mean, albeit that, you know, I was in a band as well. I was very into music.
What do you mean you were in it? I didn't know this. What band?
Yeah, well, this was school. This was school, Paul. School band. I was drums. I played drums. So that definitely helped with, you know, my capacity to be able to sort of edit music.
I never knew that. There's a wonderful David Hepworth thing that I'd recommend to people called the, I think it's called, he does it with Mark Ellen, or he did it a while ago, where he talks about, in fact, I'll upload it onto Dave's, I'll give it to Dave to upload, about the importance of a drummer. It's only 15 minutes. he is everything, you know, and people joke about drummers, but it's all rhythms. A lot of top engineers, sound designers, they're very often musicians or DJs. Most of them are, actually.
Yeah.
Some. And I didn't know you well. That's explained it.
No, and I did a bit of DJing as well. A friend and I had a mobile disco. And in fact, John Bacon, if you're listening out there, my pal and I did, we were DJs at his wedding. So we were we had our mobile disco there. So that was, yeah, brilliant.
And your brother, because I remember one, isn't he still at it?
Well, my brother, he has an outfit called Sancho Panza. So he DJs and he has a stage name of Jimmy Keitel. And he did the Notting Hill Carnival for, God, about 20 years. And it was unbelievable seeing thousands of people and he was controlling them from the deck. So an incredible thing. So, yeah, and he still does that. But yeah, does events and what have you.
I mean, I didn't. I only found out about Uncle Jimmy lately. Well, one of your sons told me that he was, I think it was Tom. So it's very much in the family, you drumming, you DJing.
Yeah, I suppose there was that. But I really had an ambition to work in a music studio, and I really wanted to work at Olympic Studios in Barnes, which was an iconic studio of that time. All the big bands, the Stones, the Who.
It was Glyn Johns, wasn't it?
Just worked there. And that's what I was aiming for. So at 18, finished school, I just thought there's only one path for me. I want to, you know, work at Olympic Studios. But I wrote to a lot of studios, and I got some really nice responses, actually. But I ended up, well, I got a response from a company called Molinaire, that they still exist. Mm-hmm. And I went in to see them. And to cut a long story short, I ended up getting a job there and pretty well got hurled into the transfer department straight away, because in those days, radio ads, I mean, commercial radio set up in 1972. I joined Molinaire in September of 1975. And for every radio ad that was made and sent out to a station, you needed 2 cartridges and 1/4-inch reel for the stations. And so it was a really, tedious job just making cartridges, cart after cart after cart.
No, just email the WAV.
Yeah, exactly. Bing. So how things have changed. And it was a very odd place. I mean,
Is it where it is now?
They were in Broadwick Street. Mm-hmm. And then in about 1978, 79, they moved to Foubert's Place, where they still are now. But it was an incredible time because, you know, as I say, commercial radio had been going for a very short time. It felt like commercial stations were popping up every other week and everybody was learning together. And there was some fantastic ideas out there.
Mm.
And, you know, when I sort of slowly got the opportunity to start working in the studio and what have you.
But did this not pull you away from the original ambition to make albums at Olympic?
It did. But once I got into a studio and started to, some amazing actors coming in, some incredible, the creative talent and these brave new ideas, I suddenly thought, actually, this is exciting. There's something in this. And it felt like the energy and the business, and because it was expanding, it was quite an extraordinary time.
I mean, it was the same for me insofar as I always found radio, I still do, maybe I'm just shallow, but the nearest thing advertising gets to show business. I love the fact I still do it, not as much as I did, but I would see someone on telly on Tuesday, think, oh, he's good or she's good. On Thursday, there they are, at Angel Sound, reading something out that I've read, and I think it's such a thrill and such a privilege.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a privilege. You and I have worked with some unbelievable actors over the years, some extraordinary talent, and to be in a position, actually, where you're sitting and, you know, giving notes and directing these seriously accomplished actors is something quite sort of special. Mm. And it is a craft that you have to learn about, you have to understand, there is psychology involved. And just to get a performance that you want.
I mean, the thing I would always do and still do, which you might not have seen because you'd be in the studio waiting and I'd go into reception and just spend 5 minutes having a chat with them. Oh, I liked you in that programme. Blah, 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 chat, chat, chat. And then when he gets into the studio, or she, they think, you like me in that programme.
Yeah.
And then go, we always did the same thing. Okay, just run through it. Don't start giving them notes before they start. And very often, their first read-through is pretty much there.
Yeah. I think a lot of that, though, I'll blow your trumpet now, it's in the writing as well, because there are rhythms in lines, there's timing.
There's drumming.
There's all of this. And finding that kind of musical tune in the voice to get a performance out and to really kind of make people sit up and listen and engage in what the person is saying. There's a lot of craft and, I love that element.
Because there is music. I've got a clip here of something I heard on Radio 4 and I got it onto an MP3 that proves that all speech is music.
The words sometimes behave so strangely.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
Wow, so there you go.
Yeah, all speech. Wow. For me at Molinaire, there was a massive kind of turning point. I felt unbelievably lucky and fortunate to be involved with a session for a product called Camping Gas, which are those kind of blue stoves and what have you for camping.
I've never liked camping. Contrived poverty, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, this is the absolutely incredible creative team. Ian Dunn, copywriter, Mark Reddy, art director.
Oh, I know,
and they
Mark.
Came up with these scripts. And I'm told that the chairman of the agency was kind of pals with Peter Sellers. And they said, let's just get Peter Sellers in to voice these ads.
And you're how old? You're a child.
Yeah, no, I was a complete child. I was a rabbit in headlights.
Peter Sellers?
You know, Peter Sellers, I mean, I was completely starstruck. I mean, I do remember he was a very serious chap. There didn't seem to be a lot of kind of joking about in between takes or anything like that. But when the machine went into record and when he had to start delivering a performance, and these ads, I mean, they took the idea of Mastermind. So he was playing like the Magnus Magnusson character. And then he was also playing the person in the chair. And I think we did about half a dozen, and he played different characters in the chair.
As he did.
And he did, yeah, all the voices. And he was, the timing, the performance, the skill, and yeah, he just sort of lit up on each take. It was quite unbelievable to witness this.
He died quite early. He was 55 in 1980. I remember it. But it's hard to convey what a star he was in the 70s, an international Hollywood star from Inspector Clouseau.
Huge.
And all the stuff that went before that in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, such a supremely talented. Yeah, and
all downhill from there.
Exactly. Yeah. And anyway, these ads won numerous awards, so that in a way was a great stepping stone for me. It helped get my name on the map a bit, and and it sort of kind of progressed from there, really.
Our next contender, Herbert Slythe, solicitor's clerk from Basingstoke, lying second after your special subject, The Life and Works of Jack the Ripper. Your general knowledge questions starting now. Who is the patron saint of travellers?
Saint Christopher.
No, camping gowns. What do Malta, Jersey and New Guinea have in common?
They're islands.
No, they all have a comprehensive refill service of camping gas cartridges and containers, as do 72 other countries. Yes. What are inseparable twins called?
Siamese?
No, twin burners on a camping gas cooker. What colour is associated with first-class cooking?
Cordon bleu.
Yes, I'll accept that. It's actually cordon bleu camping gas. Yes. Which international organisation is devoted to raising the standards of camping?
Camping gas?
Correct. Who makes the best outdoor cooking, heating and lighting appliances in the world?
Camping gas.
Correct. Okay, I've started, so I'll finish. Complete the following well-known phrase, camping...
gas.
Correct. And at the end of that round, Mr. Slythe, you've taken the lead.
Good.
But you weren't at Molinaire very long, were you? Because Angel Sound, you set up when you were how old?
Yeah, so I was 21. I was very enthusiastic. I was very naive. But, you know, as I sort of said earlier, the industry was a very, very fast moving place. I mean, commercial radio, the stations, I mean, I think when I started in 75, there were about 12 stations. We were up to like 30 stations. It was, you know, really sort of massively expanding and fast moving business.
And
think
Capital Radio was so, for want of a better word, so cool.
I mean, the talent just oozed there. I mean, Kenny Everett, who was, you know, a hero of mine, and I had the great sort of privilege of working with him a lot as well. What an unbelievable talent and creative brain. But not only that, the way he used tape, I mean, multi-tracking his own voice and having to just go through God knows how many generations down.
That would be hard enough
terms.
Now.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, through the power of digital now, a lot easier, but for sure. But yeah, what he did then, just unbelievable.
But that's when I first, I was in awe of the skit, and it was you. I went down there when I was young, and it was just the speed with which you could, I think you're going to chop his fingers off, that used to cut tape in it. It's like a bit... round your neck and then sellotape it. It was such a skill. I'm not saying engineers aren't skilled now, but it's a completely different thing.
Yeah, I think it...
Physical
skill. I sort of reflect on that, and not in a million years could I ever go back to those days. But I think to learn in that way really gives you a great sort of grounding for timing, because... there was a lot of feel in what you had to do, a bit like film editors, you know, they literally would know how, you know, they'd reel it out between their fingers, and they would know how to time a scene, and it was feel. And it was the same with quarter inch tape. I kind of knew how to space things, and I could feel, I knew 15 inches per second, 15 inches of tape was a second, and you kind of felt your way around. And then, cutting the tape, and as you say, bits of tape around your neck. I mean, it was... And again, reflecting on what we achieved then, you know, in those analog days with quarter-inch machines, cart machines, is amazing. And in fact, the point about that is it's always about a great idea, isn't it, Paul?
We know that.
You know, it starts with a fantastic idea. And in a way, whether we were just working with quarter-inch tape or more recently, really sort of sophisticated digital systems,
Without the idea.
And it was, you know, really about kind of, you know, you'd use the gear to make the idea work. But, and in fact, you know, an ad that I did a million years ago for Heineken, for Can Busters. So look, let's listen to the ad.
Report damage, Hoskins.
Flaps gone, sir.
Check.
Undercarriage shot away, sir.
Check.
I can't quite see the port engines from here, sir.
Why is that, Hoskins?
The port wing's missing, sir.
Dash. How's the radio?
I'm fine, thank you.
Radio's fine, sir.
Any news from Tail and Charlie?
Look, he sent us a postcard yesterday, sir.
Any parachutes?
No, just the postcard, sir.
Well, what about those twirly things that go round when you blow on them?
What, parachutes, sir?
No, like windmills.
Dandelions?
No. Look, here's a clue. Moo.
Oh, you mean cows, sir.
No, propellers.
But you did a noise like a cow, sir.
I can't do propellers.
Oh, well, let me try, sir.
Brilliant. Propellers.
All gone, sir.
What about the fuselage?
Well, we lost that over Bremen, sir.
Dash it, Hoskins, sir. There's nothing left of this plane.
No, sir. Sorry, sir. But there's one last chance. If I could just reach... If I could just reach this...
I'd do it myself, Hoskins, if it weren't for this dashed idleness.
I've got it, sir. A can of Heineken.
Right, the game to play is who were the actors, who were the voices.
Have you played with their voice? Have you sped them up a bit or something, or is that how they spoke?
That's how they spoke.
Because I always thought you'd vary speed.
No, that's how they spoke. Wow. So yes, the captain of the plane was Hugh Grant.
Was it?
Yeah, and his sort of co-pilot was a chap called Andy Taylor.
Oh, but, underrated Andy Taylor.
Underrated.
Very sort of funny.
But
yeah.
Hugh, him, and Chris Lang, and Stephen Fry as well. I mean, Stephen Fry was on it. They had a comedy outfit called the Jockeys of Norfolk, if I remember. I mean, this is going back to like the early 80s, so forgive me if I'm not getting all the facts
Stephen
right.
Fry was born sounding 57, wasn't he? Yeah, he really was. That doesn't sound...
Yeah, a lovely man, amazing voice. And yeah, so, and it was a kind of complicated ad to produce, but the fact was, you know, stunning idea, and we toiled and laboured and kind of got to that end result, and... Yeah, it got a lot of awards.
And
at
Stephen
the time.
Fry, who I've worked with quite a lot, he is that clever. I remember.
Oh, completely.
First thing, he's the only person I ever met who knew instantly what an aglet was. A-G-L-E-T. It's the bit on the end of your shoelaces. Immediately he knew it. Aglet.
Well, he.
Now you know the password to my computer.
Well, he taught me my favourite word, which is caesura. Because we were making this ad, and it was Stephen's sort of lovely mellifluous tones, and he'd sort of done it a few times. You know, it was pretty wonderful, and I said to him, Stephen, everything is amazing, it's lovely, but just in the middle, this particular line would really benefit from the tiniest pause between this word and this word, a hiatus of a pause. Mm. And Stephen looked up at me and reeled off about half a dozen words I could have used instead of hiatus.
Oh, really?
Including caesura, which is the tiniest pause, usually in poetry. It's not a breath. It's not a half breath. It's hardly a beat. But it just sort of punctuates something. And I just thought, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, see, a drummer would love that.
And Stephen being Stephen, you know, it was just done very kindly and sweetly, you know, wasn't sort of patronising me, and I really kind of appreciated that.
The last time we, I remember, it's a few years ago, but he, we were struggling with the script. It was over length. The client had done that usually thing. You know, they'd added so much stuff, and I was producing, and there was a writer there, and I write as well, and I went, take this out. Oh, it's still too long. And Stephen just went, why don't we take this, that, and that? All right, okay. And it was perfect. And he just waited for us to have a go, and his brain would have been going round. He knew exactly what to cut out. He wouldn't have even missed it, and it was bang on.
He's the most charming man.
Yeah.
In fact, the first time he introduced the BAFTA Awards, I went a few times with my dad. He always went, and the very, very first time, he came on stage, and there's all the big stars in the audience and everything else. And he said, came on and said, "My lords, ladies, gentlemen, Americans." and it was just brought the house down, with the caesura. But talking of sort of fine performances as well, the ad for Department of Transport, two voices at once, which was the voice Juliet Stevenson.
Now, this is something I always refer to, because I was given a talk about radio, and this woman, who I won't name, I'll name her off the air, gets on the stage and she draws this triangle. And at each point of the triangle, she puts a word. She puts good, quick, cheap. And she turns to the audience and says, "You can have 2 out of 3, but you can't have 3. And I thought, all right, okay. Then it was my turn. I don't know. I'd already had my turn. And when she finished, I came up and said, "Look, I'm awfully sorry, ladies and gentlemen. What she said is it's nonsense. Not only should ads, if obviously you've got 12-piece orchestra, it's not going to be cheap, but an ad can be good, quick, and cheap. And furthermore, it should be good, quick, and cheap. And this ad is the finest example I've ever heard of something. It's only got one voice in it that was good, quick, and cheap to produce.
It's you're four hard times to more concentrate likely to have a road accident when you're on the a mobile same time. Phone. It's you're hard four times more likely to have a road accident when you're on a mobile phone. Time. You're it's four hard times to more likely to have a road accident when you're on a mobile time. Phone. You're four times more likely to have a road accident when you're on a mobile phone. It's hard to concentrate on two things at the same time. Think. Switch your mobile off when you drive."
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Paul. The brilliance of Nick Worthington. And yeah, it hit the nail on the head as far as radio was. For radio, I mean, it went on at drive time. Very sort of captivating.
And she's good and lovely, isn't she?
Yeah. She's and it was just, it was kind of perfect in every way for a piece of radio advertising.
Yeah. And done and dusted within the hour, I would have thought. Yeah, it wouldn't take much
longer
than that.
Well, do you know what? We sort of toiled and laboured, because you kind of do. I mean, sometimes the simplest things you do a bit. But at the end of the day, hey, it was all about the idea, and it was just sort of executing it perfectly for that time.
It is the execution, because that's the other thing that's important is the idea. Obviously, everything has an idea, but I always think, that casting, that production, that precision. It's Ricky Gervais. He goes to the BBC, and he says, "I've got an idea." And the BBC said, "What's your idea, Ricky?" And he says, "Well, I've got this idea. It's about a boring bloke who works in a boring office with some boring people, and nothing much happens." And you go, "Well, that's no good, is it?" But it's the writing, it's the casting, it's the crafting.
Yeah.
And because that's not much of there's not much in that, but it's so perfectly done.
Yeah.
And actually, one of my things, and I
like to use that ad as an example, because I think there's sometimes a common misconception where there is this. People think about, well, what's radio? Radio is audio. Well, audio, we need a lot of sound. But it's like, well, actually, no, you don't. I mean, it goes back to this thing of you need an idea. Now, if the idea requires sound to really bring it to life, that is fine. But, let's start from that premise, not... I mean, I had someone come into me donkeys years ago saying, "Oh, Nick, you'll love this one. It's got 1,000 sound effects in." But it was a really weak idea, and it was a struggle. So... and it kind of missed the point. So.
And sounds aren't always what they sound like. Is it raining?
Fat frying. And interference.
Sound exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, for TV, you could probably use any three of those sounds.
And you can see it.
But if you're looking at rain, you probably believe it's rain, even though
You put bacon
I might have
on,
put yeah. fat frying or interference, but obviously in audio terms, yeah, it's got to be completely believable.
And rustling the quarter-inch tape was always the the people. And the other, have a break, have a Kit Kat. I did a few of those. That's not a Kit Kat, it's a pencil.
Exactly. Because it's
the Kit Kat doesn't make any noise.
I think we broke a number of my pencils to do that.
To do that, yeah.
If you'd like to leave a message, press 1. To be left on hold and plunged into a silent telephonic abyss, press 2. To listen to a hideous tinny version of Greensleeves, press 3. To be transferred to our understaffed call centre where our operators will be too busy to take your call, press 4. To speak to an operator who is very nice but no help at all, press 5. To be cut off for no apparent reason, press...
Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
And there's Rob Brydon on the end.
Young Rob Brydon.
Well, we knew, not just Nick and I, anyone who ever made radio commercials in the 90s, we knew Rob really well. He was he was knocking around for years because he was so good. He was such a gifted mimic that, say you didn't have a lot of money, and
huge
you wanted
talent.
You wanted two people talking to each other, but you didn't have the money to pay for two. He could sound like, and Lewis McLeod's the other one.
Yeah.
They could sound like completely different people. And when Rob sort of did Gavin and Staveton and became very famous, we're like, oh, you know, because we knew him for a very long time. And he's one of those talented people, isn't he?
It's interesting that the Kit Kat moment, I really think that was stolen from Hamlet, wasn't it? It was about arriving at a moment.
Yeah, there's only 7 ads.
Yeah, and Hamlet, which had the great sort of honour to work on many, many radio ads. Because interestingly, I don't know, the government or whoever it was didn't kind of catch up with radio as quickly as they did
with
TV and posters and press. Dissed off. But radio kind of clung on, and not only did it cling on, but it didn't even have a health warning at the end. It was just happiness is a cigar called Hamlet, the mild cigar. And it sort of went on and on. And so the investment in the kind of creative, the writing, and again, the whole sort of production was enormous because that's all that was left, radio. And of the many, many Hamlet ads that were produced, this is one of my favourites.
Sweetheart, cab's here.
Darling, do you think these trousers make my bum look fat?
No, they look all right.
All right, just all right. So you think my bum's fat?
No, you said that, I didn't.
You think it looks fat?
No, love, you look gorgeous. Okay, now come on, the cab's waiting.
You don't think they look too tight? That's...
Well, no, look, okay, maybe you should wear something different underneath,
What?
Well, your underwear, it's all sort of folded and creased up.
I'm not wearing any.
Happiness is a cigar called Hamlet, the mild cigar.
And do you recognise the voices?
I recognise Simon Pegg, because he's so good. Yeah. And that's another tip.
And Jessica Hines.
Stevenson Hines.
Yes, Hines now, isn't
it? Just that vulnerability.
Yeah, it was amazing. It took a long time to get that performance. We were kind of thinking we're not getting there, and we were almost on the point of shelving it, but we kind of persevered and just suddenly got, I felt, that the whole sort of relationship with them, and then her, the wobble in her voice at the end, and I just thought it was a wonderful kind of moment where just, yes, this is it, that hits the nail on the head.
It is that awful thing. I pride myself, but I do try and cast people properly, because I think, again, when you go to a studio, the moment the meter's running, you don't want to be wasting any time mucking about. So you've got to have the right people and do all your prep. But now and again, you get the wrong person, and they just can't do it.
But Paul, you and I, we go back a while, and I go back even further, and it's funny how that the business of casting has evolved, because really, through the 70s and the 80s, there was a pretty small club of very talented actors that were doing voiceovers. But the problem with it then was that, you know, if you wanted a, you know, a Mancunian or something, there would be certain actors who would come in and give you lots of different dialects. They weren't from that part of the world. So the whole concept of typecasting took a while to catch on. And of course, a lot of the voiceover stuff then, it was all received pronunciation. And I felt the turning point was sort of early 90s, where in fact there was a dispute between the IPA and Equity about usage rates, and that applied to actors appearing visually in TV commercials as well as usage for voiceovers for TV and radio, etc.
Because they all think they make a fortune.
And some did, and they were the brilliant ones, and they did.
They didn't get those jobs every day.
No.
And the amount of people that even now phone me up and go, a bloke phoned up not that long ago. He says, "Hello, so-and-so, give me your. I'd like to get into to voice work." And I went, "Oh, okay. What do you do at the moment?" And he goes, "Well, I work in the city as an analyst." And I went, "So you've got a job." And I just thought that's the way to deal with it. Look, I said there's lots of actors. You've got a lovely voice, but it's no lovelier than all these actors who've sacrificed everything to be.
Well, to be honest, I will write the book one day, and it'd probably be called "I've Been Told I Have a Lovely Voice."
Oh, I bet, yeah.
Because
the voice is only half of it.
Yeah. And look, there's no coincidence in the fact that the people who are really, really good at it are actually very, very good actors. And, you know, get behind a mic and have a go, because you'll soon find out that it is a tremendous skill to sort of deliver a performance, to take notes and to act on those notes, to understand timing, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's a real, real kind of talent. And I have great respect for a lot of these actors. But so there we were in the 90s, and that dispute was going on. But also there seemed to be a sort of a shift going on from that whole kind of received pronunciation to more colloquial performances. And we were embracing dialects more, and the writing was really moving towards that thing of talking to people, not at them, and more conversational. And, you know, there were so many, I mean, amazing actors who made a tremendous amount of money from being the end line, you know, the Robert Powells and the Anthony Valentines and so on. Lovely people. And but these immaculate voices with received pronunciation, and really it was changing. We no longer wanted that.
And then it, I think, went too far the other way. Got to talk to you like that, otherwise you'll not understand me. And you think, oh, please.
You have to try these things.
Yeah,
don't
you do.
You?
But I think there was a point, like there is in everything, where it's just about right. It had gone from that sort of, you know, received pronunciation,
BBC.
But let me take you back from the 90s to the 80s, when Angel Sound really got. Started coming there.
The company opened its doors October 1979, and. Wow, you know, I mean, we said earlier, I was young, very enthusiastic, very driven.
Very fast with the scalpel.
Yeah, very, very fast with the razor blade.
I think I have to point out here, like a lot of people, because yours was the only name on the door, and it was very successful. He's loaded. He's a multi-millionaire. But, of course, there's always, you know, you're 21 years old. You must have partners.
That's absolutely right. There was Chris Sanford. In fact, it was Chris and I that conceived the idea in the very first place. And we're still friends to this day. He was a great mentor of mine. He was an actor by trade. A voiceover, did an awful lot of voiceovers.
He did when I first started.
At that time, there was a kind of club of voiceovers.
Yeah, not that many. He was
very much
a leading
in
light.
That club, and he was a great mentor to me. And he had a radio production company that he set up called Hobo Radio.
Oh, Hobo, yeah.
And he did some wonderful work, and I pretty well worked on everything that he did. And so our relationship was amazing. You know, the quality of work that was produced between us, I think, was Yeah, we're both proud of that.
He's a nice man as well. And didn't he have a hit record in the 60s? I'm sure he did.
He did. He a star in Coronation Street. And he had a hit record. Yeah, and also he was part of a comedy duo called Yin and Yang with the late, great Bill Mitchell.
Oh, Bill.
Bill, the man. I mean, some of our audience will remember Bill.
They might not know him by name,
but he had the deepest voice.
The deepest voice.
He was the original.
That's about as much as I can do. I'll tell you a story about Bill, because you could only book him in the mornings, because, to put it mildly,
he liked to drink.
And one day, you'd find him singing in Kettner's in the afternoon. And he said to me, again, I was around Angel. He goes, I'll be in Kettner's later. Come on, have a drink. And he looked exactly like he sounded. He had the black Stetson. And
he always
the man
wore
in black.
Completely black, like, shades, black.
Yeah,
black
long
everything.
Before Johnny Cash. And so he goes around there and he said, come around and join me at Kettner's. So about 1:30 I go around there and Bill's already, he's had a couple and he's belting out Delilah. And accompanying him on the piano is Neil Sedaka.
Really?
This is, you know, and when people say that, you know, advertising's not as much fun as it used to be, I think they've got a point.
No, he was an absolutely wonderful man. And in some ways, it was sad that the drink in the end kind of got to him. And he, I don't know, he was slightly sort of ridiculed for it, and he was a very, very talented man indeed, and really
it wasn't just a deep voice, was it?
It wasn't just a deep voice. He understood the nuance and the whole kind of performance thing and what was required. He really knew how to use his voice, and Chris and him together as Yin and Yang. I mean, Chris, the higher voice and the sort of comedic character, that it was a fantastic kind of partnership there. And they did, do you remember Telly Savalas had a single called If,
yeah,
and they did a spoof of that, which was very funny.
I hear that record sometimes and I can't believe it got to number one, but it did,
you know? I know, different times.
Yeah, children, Google Telly Savalas If, you'll see me on Top of the Pops in the 70s. No, I mean, just all these names keep coming up. Because Nick Angel, because my name is Paul Burke, and, you know, I got it at school. Burke by name, Burke by nature, even though Cockney rhyming slang for Berkeley Hunt. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah steady.
So I always had name envy. I think Nick Angel is a great name. You know, it really is. And it was there was a Nick Angel with one L in a Jackie Collins book, wasn't there? I remember you got that letter.
Well, funnily enough, now this was with Chris Amford as well, where back in the 80s, we were making an ad for one of her books, whatever it was called, Hollywood Husbands or something.
Something like that.
And Chris came into the studio with Jackie Collins.
Do you know, I think I know what it's called. I think it's called Lucky Star.
The book was called An American Star.
American Star.
But anyway, Chris came into the studio with Jackie Collins and said, oh, Jackie Collins, this is Nick Angel, Jackie Collins. And she looked at me and said, oh my God, I read, that's an amazing name. I'm going to remember that and I might use it one day. So, of course, it was a standing joke for the next few weeks in the studio that, you know, I was going to be the next stud in a Jackie Collins novel. And time passed, it was forgotten. And many years later, I mean, I think it must have been at least 7 years later, perhaps a little bit more. My wife and I, on a Sunday evening, sitting on the sofa watching Aspel and Co., and Jackie Collins was a guest. And there was a lot of serious talk because I think her husband had recently died of cancer and it was all a bit awkward. But anyway, they got on to, Aspel asked Jackie Collins, so Jackie, you have a new book, you know, tell us a little bit about it. And she said, well, yes, it's called An American Star. And it's about this guy, Nick Angel. I thought, hang on a minute, this is a wind-up. And again, Nick Angel is the Nick Angel that. And I thought, no, I can't believe. And so she clearly had somewhere had gone in. So I wrote to her agent kind of saying, you know, some 7-8 years ago, you know, I met Jackie Collins and,
delighted,
you know,
flattered.
Yeah, related the story. And I said, look, I'm sure there's absolutely no similarity between the character and me, but I'd very much love to read the book. Some 3 months later, I got a letter which I have here.
You've still got from it. I remember
her.
You bringing
I
it to
know.
The studio. You just got it.
And here's her address, Beverly Hills 90210.
Of course.
Of course. And it said, Dear Nick, well, I guess my subconscious must have been at work because I failed to recall our meeting and conversation, exclamation mark. But I do think Nick Angel, brackets with my second L, is the most wonderful name, and I've enclosed the book... for your pleasure, I do hope you find him to be a wonderful character. With all good wishes, Jackie Collins. Oh. And then inside the book, she wrote to the real Nick Angel, love, Jackie.
Yeah, she remembered. Like sometimes you don't remember, but when someone prompts you, go, oh, yeah, of course, it was that.
Yeah.
And then there's the other... I don't know if you go to the cinema a lot, but there's this Nick Angel who turns up at the... And so many people, I mean, Saskia said it to me once, Is that Nick? Is that your friend?
Yeah, well, look, yeah. This is a platform now, an opportunity for me to explain this and clear this up.
But he's got one L
so
as well,
he has got one L. Yeah. It is another Nick Angel, the one that sort of pops up on these film titles, although I have had my name on film titles, but not in the same capacity that he operates. And he was an A&R guy at Island Records, and he forged a relationship with Richard Curtis on the film Bridget Jones' Diary, the original one, because he was involved, I think, with the album, the licensing of the music, and it was an incredibly successful, I think it was the most successful album of that year.
Just before sort of streaming took over, people would go back out and buy the CD,
and literally, I mean, millions, they sold millions, and he then ended up working for Working Title with Richard Curtis as an in-house music supervisor and all of those kind of Curtis films, and getting his name up there. So, of course, I trade off the goodwill of his name, and my wife frequently tells me she married the wrong one. and we had this bizarre thing, again, I mean, this is ever such a long time ago, where we went on this holiday, and it was like a Mark Warner holiday, all activity holiday, and our
kids were small.
The kids were small, and there was our name up on the board, Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L, you know, activities this, X, Y, Z. Then in the second week, there was the name again, A-N-G-E, and only one L. And if there's one thing that really annoys me is when there's only one L. And anyway, this guy came up to me and said, are you Nick Angel? And I said, yeah.
Who wants to know?
And he said, so am I. And it was this guy. And in fact, our paths had kind of crossed because I'd worked for the record company for their marketing department, and people had got confused and I never knew why. So our paths had very much crossed, coincidentally. But look, this is the platform to kind of clear it up. As much as I would, you know, love to take the credit for some of that music supervision and et cetera that he does. Yeah, that's not me. He's one L. I'm two L's.
I'd rather have two L's. I absolutely would. Yeah, never mind music supervision. So going back to Angel Sound with two L's, you did have some great engineers.
Oh, I mean, there have been so many great people over the years and many who sort of moved on to other companies as well and forged great careers. But I mean, you know, Bill Gauthier was a guy, right? Early days with me. But I mean, people that I sort of remember fondly, Rob Townsend, who you'd know,
Bobby T,
that you would know very well.
Dave
Robinson, Crawford Blair. I mean, it would be a list of people, and I don't want to bore the audience with names.
All good, and all thoroughly trained through transfer. Yeah. So that by the time they were allowed anywhere near the mixing desk, they sort of knew what they were doing.
I hope I've formed part of that kind of journey of learning, etc. Yeah. But for me, learning was about working with fantastic creative talent, and I mean, I think at the top of that tree, Mr. Tim Delaney, who a creative director who I probably learnt more from than anyone else, just because the way he went about the work that we were doing on radio was different to everyone else.
See, I've only met him once.
he's
a terrible rep, but he's a kind man underneath, isn't he? That's what everyone says.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, very, very driven, very, very clever, a fantastic writer, an amazing creative brain, a real intellect, and someone who actually, irrespective of whether or not it was a short little radio ad or, you know, a huge TV extravaganza, the approach was the same, was to get it as good as it could possibly be. And, you know,
didn't
my...
really care about the budgets, did he, as well, Tim? Which was
no, no. And that was at a time where, in a way, that was allowed to happen. And thank God for it, because it, when I reflect on the campaign that I worked on with him for Philips, with Mel Smith, the amazing Mel Smith, and Griff Rhys-Jones. And what was interesting, let's play the one ad that, you know, absolutely won squillions of awards. Everything.
Morning, Squire.
Morning, sir.
I'd like a video caster, please.
A video recorder. Anyone in particular?
Well, I'd like to add some specifications.
Yes.
And functions. I must have some functions.
I see. Did you have any model in mind?
Well, a friend mentioned the Arikiri Kabuki Kasuni Kawachamakalik. You know, the Japanese one, the 2000. Because I'm very technically minded, you see.
I can see that.
So I want one with all the bits on it. All the Japanese bits. You know, the 2000.
What system?
Electrical, I think. Because I'd like to be able to plug it into the television, you see. I've got a Japanese television.
Have you?
Yeah, I thought you'd be impressed. Yeah, the 2000, the Okie-Kokie 2000.
Well, sir, there is this model.
Yeah, well, it looks smart, yeah.
8 hours per cassette, all the functions that the others have, and I know this will be of interest. Mm. A lot of scientific research has gone into making it easy to operate, even by a complete idiot like you.
Yeah, pardon?
It's a Philips.
Doesn't sound very Japanese.
No, a Philips. A Philips. It's a Philips.
Yeah. Well, it's a 2000, is it?
Well, in fact, it's the 2023.
No, it hasn't got enough knobs on it, no. What's that one over there?
That's a washing machine.
Yeah, what, so Japanese?
The VR2023. Video you can understand. From Philips.
Actually, I can still picture them now sitting in the studio doing that and all the other Philips ads that we did. And in fact, an anecdote from that time is that I had the studio set up in a certain way, and we used to use acoustic screens to separate the mics and what have you. And before we started the journey of recording all the Philips ads, we talked about how we wanted to, Mel and Griff, how to sort of set them up in the studio, how to position them, because it was very much about there was this improvisation thing that went on, and we wanted them to be able to play off each other and look each other in the eyes. And so I had them facing each other, absolutely facing each other, with a table in between, the mics back to back, and in fact they were side on to Tim and I in the control room, and that's how we did it. And I'm pretty proud to tell you in fact they use that very setup for their TV program, Alas Smith and Jones, where you saw them kind of sitting side on to you, talking to each other
in white shirts against a black background.
And that they weren't wearing white shirts. I don't think in my studio, but
Mel would have spilt red wine down this, wouldn't they?
But that is, you know, I'm really proud to sort of say that that's where it came from, that idea. So
so much TV does come from radio, and it's not just programs, commercials too, by the sounds of it.
Now
you come to mention it, and I'm very familiar with Philips and with the other ones, that does make sense. I mean, as a person, as someone listening to it, I do see a man going into a shop buying a video recorder, but now you come to mention it and knowing what I know about them and how things are recorded, that's exactly how they would have been. You started that.
All that sort of interaction. Exactly.
I mean, listening again to Philips, I wonder whether people would frown upon that. Would it be seen as... the Japanese are still fair game, aren't they, for some reason, like the Americans?
Would be happy? Would a client be happy with the changing of their name now? Who the hell knows? But it was absolutely the right decision that Philips to allow it to go out, and that they didn't have an issue with it.
No.
And it was a fantastic thing. But I think what's interesting about the way those ads were made, and I don't think that could ever be reproduced now, was that Tim had engaged some very talented writers, including Mel and Griff, to just come up with ideas. And these ideas, they would arrive in the studio with these ideas scribbled on a piece of paper.
It was John Cantor among them as well, wasn't he?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, he did some stuff as well. That's clever talk back, not the 9 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. All of that crew.
I mean, these are hugely intelligent people.
Rory McGrath.
Yeah, I've worked with a lot of them.
Mel, though,
of course. I mean, I've never seen anyone eat, drink and smoke as much as Mel.
He lived life.
Yeah, he enjoyed himself, didn't he?
To the max.
Sort of Hogarthian figure.
Lovely man.
Yeah, lovely man.
A hugely talented. And we used to call it radio workshopping. We kind of christened it that because Tim, Mel and Griff would arrive. I was there, obviously. And in they'd trot to the studio. and with these sort of bits of scraggy ends of paper with ideas scribbled down, and they would improvise these ideas. And I mean, actually, I don't remember the sessions being that funny. In fact, it was I learned at that time that it was a very serious business creating great comedy. And they'd do a couple of takes. They'd be a bit all over the shop, and Mel and Griff would come into the control room, and then there would be a lot of intense conversation about what was good, what was bad, what was funny, what wasn't funny. Right, no, we need to cut this, we need to improve that joke, etc.
Such a luxury to work
Yeah, an amazing luxury. And look, again, Tim was unbelievable because the creative direction, the discipline to really
And he wasn't frightened to say what wasn't funny.
Not at all.
To these big stars.
Yeah, no, sure. Not at all. Yeah. And to really sort of maximise every kind of moment. And so back into the studio they go, and another couple of takes come out, more discussion. And we sort of went on this journey with every ad that was made for Philips.
And how long were you in there?
But well, it was always an evening, and it would always be a few hours in the evening. And then I would sort of collate something, send it over to the guys. There would be a lot of listening and head scratching. Then they'd come back again for another evening, and we'd either refine or we'd tweak. I mean, there was a lot of effort that went into it. And, you know, Philips actually, you know, that was over a period of time. But the performance is so kind of wonderful. Everything is so tight, so well executed. It's a magnificent thing, but all of them were. But here's the thing, Paul. There were no predetermined timings for any of them, right?
No.
At all.
Because that's the bane of our lives, getting into 30.
Yeah, everything is now 30, isn't it? So, or less. And there were no predetermined timings. But again, credit to Tim, because it was about, because I think things can go the wrong way. You know, you can get very indulgent. And it was about, look, we want this idea to absolutely work in all its glory, but it needs to be super tight and every moment needs to work. Because in a way, the longer an ad is, the better it has to be to hold the attention. So come on.
And we do hear some that are too long, don't we?
Completely. Yeah, you know, they're too indulgent. Yeah. And there was a real discipline in the studio about, it wasn't just being long for the sake of it. It was about the idea of filling the right time slot. And some of the ads, we did a 70, there'll be a 60, but then a shorter one, a 40. They were all over the shop. And once they were crafted to within an inch of their lives, Tim would just say to Philips, right, this is what we've made, and this is what you're going to put on air. And the relevant time slot. Yeah, and they bought into it. The time slot was bought. And that was what was done. And to me, I just think, because what happens now is that it almost the time length of an ad is predetermined you get, as the creative, get the brief.
Always.
So now you're told, oh, we want this, we want that, and you've got 30 seconds.
And also they always do that same thing, that they try to cram far too much in. The thing you always say to them is, look, if I throw one ball at you, you'll catch it. If I throw 10 at the same time, I'm going to drop the lot. And they often do. And they think as long as they've actually got those things in physically in 30 seconds, right, they can go back to the boss and say, yes, I've got it all in there. And, it's a shame. Now, that's the great
conundrum.
I mean, did they do the same sort of thing for Nationwide Anglia?
Yeah. I mean, Nationwide Anglia, which actually was Mel Smith. And, the approach, I mean, Tim always took these sort of, you know, outside-the-box kind of approaches. And, well, the quality in the end was always there for everyone to kind of hear. And but, you know, the craft effort.
Something's well made, whether it's a radio commercial or a jacket or a table.
Yeah.
It's well made. It's going to last. And, they've lasted.
But a friend and I did a talk not so long ago in Dublin for the Irish IPA. And we were talking about, you know, what makes radio better, and that was, you know, creativity and production and craft skills, casting, blah blah blah.
A bloke called Barry.
What
was it for? A bloke called Barry.
What? Who we did it for? No,
I went and did that, or something like. Anyway, sorry. Oh,
No, a lovely lady called Charlie.
Okay.
But I really wanted to emphasize that point because there were some clients in the audience about don't, you know, close down the creative process before it's even begun by just sort of allowing the media company to say, oh, it's a 30-second slot and get on with it. You know, just what about sort of getting the brief out there, exploring ideas, developing those ideas, applying some discipline, not just writing a book, you know, but then have a look at, well, actually, what time length would really do justice to this idea, make it stand out on radio? And it just seems
because sometimes it makes them shorter. You think, actually,
yeah,
that would be better in 30.
Yes. I mean, but that's what I'm saying is know, if the I idea know. Suits a 30, do a 30. Yeah, I'm not saying that don't do 30, but...
No, but the media companies, it's all charts and numbers, and they tell the client that it's more cost-effective to have these. And... you know, it's that old argument that they may be more cost effective and you'll get more goes on the air, but people won't have noticed it.
They've
washed over them. Shame.
I mean, you and I, you know, America's been at it for a long, long time, haven't they? And in fact, you and I have sat on DNAD radio judging panels and...
thinking, why can't we do this?
Yeah, and Budweiser. I mean, if you want to talk about craft in a radio ad, I think, I mean, and how many years did Real Men of Genius, I mean, it just kept winning. And in fact, it got to a point where people were saying, oh, we can't award that again because, you know, they've already been winning for the last couple of years.
And I remember having that. And my argument was, look, if an athlete is entering the Olympics again, you can't say, well, you can't win. You won it last year and the year before, you know, you lost. But they were the best ads in the world, weren't they?
Unbelievable. I mean, well, here's one of them.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Nosebleed Section Ticket Holder Guy.
Mr. Nosebleed Section Ticket Holder Guy.
Congratulations. With the help of two Sherpas and a mountain goat, you have finally reached your seats.
Touch the sky.
Tickets, check. Souvenir, check. Oxygen mask, check.
Getting dizzy.
From where you sit, you can see your house and Canada and Japan.
I see Okinawa.
The one thing you can't see, the game.
Oh, no!
So crack open an ice-cold Bud Light, oh, chairman of the cheap seats. Because you, sir, sit on top of the world. Literally.
Mr. Nosebleed Section, you can hold the guy.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
You listen to that and the craft, every part of the craft, the you know, I love the performance of the voiceover, the singer. I mean, although the kind of music, it was the same tune, but obviously the singer, they had to kind of work it around to suit the voiceover, and the ideas were so good. And it was just wonderful, you know, beautifully done.
Do you want to hear another one? Here we go. It's so good. You need to know that there were so many of these, and it just wasn't just a one-off. So you're getting two.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. 80 SPF sunblock wearer.
Mr. 80 SPF sunblock wearer.
There are 24 hours in a day. You're wearing 80-hour protection. If the sun fails to go down, you'll be ready.
Don't forget the moonlight.
Your coconut-scented force field blocks out all the sun's rays and any stray rays from another sun in another galaxy.
Your star!
30 SPF, please. You might as well be wearing cooking oil.
Something smells delicious.
So crack open an ice-cold Bud Light, Mr. 80 SPF sunblock wearer. In fact, feel free to crack one open at high noon in the middle of the Sahara Desert.
Mr. 80 SPF sunblock wearer.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Well, of course, and you and I have done a whole sort of bunch of ads together, including
have.
The Guardian.
Yeah, that's when I really did set up Camp in Angel Sound. What it was... I was at BMP at the time. I'd just gone there. For younger listeners, that's now called Adam and Eve. And they had The Guardian, and nobody wanted this brief. It was to write a brand new radio commercial every single day for a month. And Frank Budgeon, who was my group head, great Frank Budgeon, gave me the brief and just let me get on with it. I mean, there wasn't really time. There was time to get approved by the client, but there wasn't time for much else. I could never find Frank anyway. He was famously elusive. So I'd just write it. And if I was happy with it, the client was happy with it, and the RACC approved it, I would just run down to Angel Sound. And Mandy Wheeler was the producer. Now, Mandy, for my money, the greatest radio producer who ever lived, and I owe her so much. It was Mandy that sort of ignited my love of radio. And we would just record them, and they'd be on the air the next day. And I think I wish I had some more of them, because it sounds really conceited. They were good. But one of them survives. I think Nigel, one of your ex-engineers, did. It was whoever was available at 4 o'clock. It was a little kick, bollock and scramble. But we did this live in the studio. The guitar, it's Ronnie Golden playing the guitar, right, standing next to the voiceover.
And the right voiceover, remind me who the voiceover was?
It was Brian Croucher.
Oh, yeah.
Who played, he was in EastEnders. Yeah. He wasn't in EastEnders at the time. But again, Mandy Wheeler, I'd never heard of Brian Croucher.
Yeah.
She introduced me to Hugh Dennis, to Hugh Laurie, to casting. Roger Allam, people that I don't think she ever brought a bad person in.
Yeah.
Awful lot to thank. Well, you, Frank,
shall we listen
Frank
to one
Budgeon,
of them?
Yeah, let's listen to the one surviving Guardian ad from all those years ago.
A certain part of Spain has become a haven for a certain part of society. In today's Weekend Guardian, meet some characters in bars who perhaps ought to be behind them. The Guardian, a newspaper with a weekend section of its own.
I mean, the wonderful thing with newspapers, of course, is that they really did... It was about stories, wasn't it? And so there was a great kind of platform and opportunity to... You know, lots of ideas. You were churning these out, weren't you?
Absolutely. I loved it. Because I think I'd like to have been a journalist. I think I'd have enjoyed that. But they didn't have them at The Guardian. Did they have much truck with ad agencies? And we produce a bloody newspaper every day. What do you mean you need 3 weeks to write a script? They had a point.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, certainly my experience of working with many of the newspaper groups, and I had a long, long run with News International for Sun and News of the World. They were very, I mean, there was definitely that attitude. We can get a paper out in a day, so what's your problem? And also what was great was that it was either yep or no. I mean, it was, yeah, like it, don't like it. There was nothing really in between.
And in the nicest possible way, they didn't, unless there was a real mistake in it or it was just a bit shit, which sometimes they were, but they weren't that bothered in the nicest possible way. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, good. Yeah, nice. And already, I think they knew they didn't have time to turn it down. And weren't that bothered anyway. If you've got something and you can record it, if it's on the air tomorrow, fine. So it's never a problem.
But Paul, I mean, you've sort of had this amazing kind of passion for radio for a long time. And, you know, you're a great writer.
Well, it's because this isn't a lie. I mean, my wife will tell you this. I'm pretty useless at everything else. So you think if I'm not good at this, I'd have to sell the kids on eBay. Talking of which, I'd been going out with this girl for 3 months. This is just an aside, you'll like this. I was going out with this girl for 3 months, and she was Danny Baker's agent. And I wanted to use him for a voiceover, and I got to know her. And I used one of the other actors. And her office, the agent's office, was literally just around the corner from Angel Sound in Covent Garden. And one of her actors came in, and she said, oh, can I come along and see how it works? So she trots in with her actor, and... she's sitting with me and Nick's doing the session, and she's very friendly, very nice. And after she went, Nick turns to me and goes, agent, I think she likes you. And I said, I hope so. She's having my child. And I didn't tell my mum first. I didn't tell any of my family. The first person who knew I was ever going to be a father was Nick Angel. True. Absolutely true. Still loves you to this day. You know that.
Oh, she's a lovely, lovely lady. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I nearly fell off my perch when you said that.
Because I had only been with her for 3 months, you know.
And we also had some fun with VW, didn't we?
We did. Because the lovely thing about BMP, when it became BMP DDB and the lovely Tony Cox took over as creative director, Tony was a great delegator. He's one of those people that didn't seem to do very much, but the moment he left, he wasn't there, he was just the best creative director. I came in with a VW script for him, and he goes to me, do you think it's any good? And I went, well, yeah, because otherwise I wouldn't show it. Okay, yeah, you're probably right. You did all that Guardian stuff, didn't you? And I said, yeah. He goes, yeah. You probably know more about radio than me. Why don't you just look after that? Don't bother me with that. And that, it wasn't a lazy thing. It was, I hate this phrase, but it was empowering in that I was, the buck stopped here. And I had to make sure that I was given complete freedom to write, produce, everything. And the lovely thing was, what we used to do, again, it was a freedom, a sort of Phillips-esque freedom. I could write anything I wanted with anyone I wanted for the Golf, the Polo, the you know, the Passat. And they'd all go on a cassette, CD by then, all on a CD. They'd be sent out to the dealers, and the dealers go, yeah, we like that one. We've got a few Golfs we need to shift. Can we just put our name on the end of that? And I did so many of them, Angel, including this one. This was a slightly difficult brief. But just remember, if you get a brief and you've got nothing to say, say nothing.
What can you say about the legendary Volkswagen Golf GTI that hasn't been said before? Nothing. Which is why this 40-second commercial is going to be rather difficult to fill. Would you like to hear some music? I mean, it's the definitive GTI. Then, everyone knows that. For your Golf GTI, contact Poplar Garage, Norfolk Street, King's Lynn.
Time's up.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah, I love that. Who was, remind me, who was the our actor on that?
Oh, you mean me, the one who says time's up?
No.
No, the main man was,
I knew that was, you.
Yeah, was Chris Langham.
Oh, yes. Oh. Yes. Oh, the fall from grace, Mr. Chris Langham. An incredible actor, a really clever man, a deeply flawed human being. So, his comedic timing, unbelievable.
Rob did that one at Angel, and I don't think we did anything. Chris just came in and did it.
Yeah.
And he seemed to know how much to leave. We didn't stretch that or anything. You can tell. That's not stretched at all. It's a shame. For those who don't know, Chris was sort of Operation U-Tree came knocking for him. And it's a shame because he'd had issues with drugs and things like that. And you wouldn't think it to know him. He was sort of very respectable and spoke very well and just had the brilliant use of a wry eyebrow, a wry brow, if you will. He was fantastic, but he'd just got himself back together. He'd starred in the original series of The Thick of It before Roger Allam took it. He was the MP, and then they couldn't use him again. And the other thing is Paul Whitehouse always got really mad because he and Chris had just done this brilliant program. Check it out if you can. Not that you can get it on DVD, called Help. Where
that's right.
Chris Langham was the therapist,
yeah,
and Whitehouse was all the characters, and Paul's like, "Mad gal, you know, can't, you know." Just as they'd done it, just as it went out on DVD, because of Chris Langham was disgraced, it all they came off the shelves, and then Paul wrote something else called Nurse about a district mental nurse where she goes around, and Paul once again is all the characters. Again, he was a real talent.
I mean, Harry and Paul, of course, I've worked with a million times back in the day. And,
Paul was the funny bloke at school, wasn't he? Who did impressions of the... You could just tell. I always remember Paul coming in... Again, I'm not making this up, no reason to. It was at Angel Sound. And he, even though Harry was renowned for Stavros and loads of money and had a hit record as, you know, loads of money in the 80s, Paul put those voices on. He was just talking to us. And something about, and I think Neil Harrington was the engineer, something about the way Paul did it, after he went, Neil and I went, he did that first, didn't he? There was something about it was a more original, it was something different.
Yeah.
I never heard him do it, heard Harry do it a million times. But again, I just have to keep banging on. A privilege to have these people read out something you've written.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're very lucky
very,
to be able
lucky.
To say that.
Very lucky.
So now it's here we are.
We have to say we're in Floral Street, and it was just a cool place to be where you were.
Yeah, so we were in Floral Street. I was there from 1979 to 1998,
yeah.
And we got the premises in Wardour Street and moved in there.
Literally, you went up in the world because you were in the basement, and then you went up to the fifth floor.
Yeah, well, I had to. I needed, you know, I went from having no natural light to lots of natural light, and that was the top of the search criteria, because I was going slightly stir crazy, and particularly in the winter where you'd go into the studio and, you know, it was dark in the morning and it was dark when I came out, and I think I was going a bit weird. I mean, obviously it helped me keep my youthful looks, but
the other thing about you, seriously, and you know this, is everyone wanted to work with you. So the downside of being a successful and sought after engineer is you're locked in a basement from 9 till 6 every single day.
And I really was. And that was the crazy times. And, of course, you know, I went through the... because when I started at Molinaire, there was all the TV commercials were done... It was filmed. So there were film dubbing studios and they were doing the sound. But, of course, video came in, and then we could lock tape machines to video machines. And obviously, companies like mine... Suddenly, we were given the chance, really, to start working on TV ads. So, you know, I'm afraid the film dubbing studios faded away and went, and we took over. So as much as my passion was very much radio, and, you know, I really, really loved doing it, but I, you know, I did an awful lot of TV as well. And
well, we did some TV not that long. Yeah. For, I mean, not going to play it, really, but it was just that it was for Birdseye. And you could see the plates and the fish fingers. And then we recorded the sound separately.
That's right.
And
they were real families.
Yeah, they were real people. I've got loads of stories about those people. There was one family up in Newcastle we went to see. They were the nicest people in the world. And I just wanted to stay at their house. And the bloke said to me, they were just about to put the Champions League on and went to get the train back to London. And the man and wife really met it. And the kids said, oh, why don't you stay? Come on. You get a train back in the morning. They meant it, you know. We went around the country doing that. And then Nick is so good at editing speech and getting it to fit the TV, which is something I'd never really used you for, because I do try and avoid anything with pictures just because it was...
and there were 1,000 edits in those, weren't there?
Oh, God, yeah. But Jerry Moira got me into do those because they were basically radio commercials that you could see. So... That I'd almost forgotten that I could go to Angel Sound or anywhere really to do TV.
Yeah, no, I mean that thing, yeah. Well, and obviously, yeah, I was part of that.
Watching
the way the industry evolved and changed and embraced, you know, the new way. Wow, video and videotape machines and locking audio machines to 1/4-inch tape machines to video machines and doing sound to picture. So that was a great kind of learning curve as well. And
because radio started to again, it sounds like nostalgia, but it's true. Radio was treated really seriously. There was the ILR Awards, the International Local Radio Awards. It was like DNAD, and it was that big. It was the Grosvenor House. It was a massive do. For radio only, and every category up to 30, up to 40, best drama, best, and your table was
no.
We
had some good times.
As soon as I could get to the Angel Sound table,
material. I've reflected on that, and we, you know, it was a lovely time, and
it was a lucky time. Yeah.
But you know, a lot of effort went into kind of doing the best we could.
Because you had DNAD, which was everything, but you really had proper big dudes. There was Campaign Press, BTA television, and the ILR was as big. I went to all of them.
At
the Grosvenor, full on, full house,
black tie.
And then that got this was good, actually. This actually leads to Angel Sound. It got replaced by the Sony radio. Well, not so much replaced. Nick and I worked on Sony, and I developed this character because I've always had a thing about hospital radio. I mean, it's probably, I think, the invention of the Walkman, and certainly the iPod and the just did for, but people, it sounds really weird now. There were proper, fully equipped radio stations, Angel Sound style desks in hospitals to play requests for people that were ill or dying. And this very funny, eccentric bloke, still around, called Tom Binns, had this character called Ivan Brackenbury. Again, with your understanding of radio and your, I'm sure like me, sort of a dislike of hospital radio, there was only one place I could bring this. Again, one of these survived, so here's this.
Hello, it's me, a friend of mine, Ivan Brackenbury on Hospital Radio.
Ivan Brackenbury!
Your award-winning DJ. Just a joke. Anyway, what have I been up to? Some madcap fundraising events for vital hospital equipment. And I've bought a brand new Sony mini disc player. It's fantastic. Digital quality recording. So I pre-recorded my whole show on one Sony mini disc. I can put my feet up now for 74 minutes. If I can just find it.
He's bonkers.
No, I really have lost it. I haven't got any tapes or LPs with me either.
He's bonkers.
Sony mini disc. Perfect copies every time.
Yes.
Now, that won quite a few awards. The trouble is, Chris Evans had the breakfast show on Virgin, and he absolutely loved Ivan Brackenbury. He thought it was brilliant. He played them. He'd play them again, even when he wasn't supposed to, because there was a whole campaign of them. And I got a thing from Virgin Radio, from the Chris Evans production staff, saying, who is this bloke? How can we get hold of him? And I gave them Tom's details. And then every Friday, Tom would go in and be Ivan Brackenbury and do a little sort of 15-minute hospital radio sketch on Chris Evans' show. So hugely successful. Got me onto the committee of the Sony Radio Awards because the client at Sony said, oh, this is great. You can. But so they go, DNAD comes round and I'm not on the jury this time, which I was, because they went in and people were going, yeah, they're good, but he's just ripped them off the Chris Evans show.
Oh no!
Yeah, it was the other way around. And of course, you've won lots of awards. I know that, particularly for Philips and with Mel and Griff and that lovely ad we played earlier on, the two voices. But there was one particular award presented by me that I remember you getting. Remember that one?
I do, Paul. Actually, look, I want to just clear up one thing that I've been part of a team winning awards, because I hate to think of me, because all of these awards, and there have been many, but I've obviously in the front line of those are lots of very talented people, you included, Mr. Burke.
Well, that's very kind about the ones that I actually wrote, but this particular award was for you and only you.
Yes, well, yeah. This was a hugely flattering award that you very kindly gave to me on behalf of the Radio Advertising Bureau, and it was the Aerial Awards. It was in 2006 and it was a Lifetime Achievement Award, which kind of worried me a bit because I felt that I was still a bit too young to be getting a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, you were, and it was years. You kept going for years,
you know,
after that.
Was I about to sort of peg over at that stage, and so they just needed to get it out there quickly.
Or but, there's something we've been trying to tell you. it's been great. No, it was such a joy to give you that, and I was flattered to be the person that even gave it to. It was richly deserved.
Well, I was hugely proud to receive it, and it was a great honour and a great accolade, and I suppose it was a reflection of the many, many, many radio award winners and, you know, radio in general that I've been involved with.
Yeah, it's your love. It was not just an award for awards. It was an award for a love of radio and an investment in the medium.
That's
very
true.
Because you could, and you have, you've done lots of TV, but you're always the go-to person for, I've got a good script here. I know where I'm going to take it. And no, that was fantastic. But the nice thing is it wasn't a lifetime achievement because you did carry on for many, many years
afterwards. I really did. Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, you still are.
I still am. And in fact, in my new guise now, I am still kind of producing some radio and out there doing it, which is such a joy and a pleasure to do.
So rumours of your death have been greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, no, it's been brilliant times.
Mm. Just so many memorable sessions with people that went on to be more famous than they are now. Radio commercial you did for The Spectator.
Ah, it's The Spectator, featuring a certain person who is currently our Prime Minister, Mr. Boris Johnson, who was, as we all know, was editor of The Spectator for a long time. And he came in to voice the ad for The Spectator. And I mean, immediately I knew that I was in the presence of a very big brain, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But he didn't really quite give you eye contact, and he seemed to be a bit all over the shop in that he was thinking of the next thing. He was constantly, he was on the move the whole time. Anyway, he did the ad, absolutely fantastic, came back into the control room. There was other people from the Spectator and what have you. All right, is that okay? Everyone okay? And he said, I've got a dash. And he picked up his coat, opened the door, went to leave. And somebody from the other side of the room said, Boris. And he turned around and said, yes. He said, that's my coat. And he picked up someone else's coat and was putting it on going out of the door. He went, what? Oh, yeah, sorry. Which is mine? Oh, yes. So clearly quite mad, but brilliant mad.
Yeah, but it's nice when people turn out exactly as you think they should. I remember going into the Floral Street downstairs and Stephen Burkhoff was in reception. And I didn't know him from Adam. And all I heard him saying was, they didn't even know my fucking name. You know, exactly how you would expect Stephen Burkhoff to behave. No, yeah. They usually are like they are.
Some of those guys they were intimidating. Mm. And in fact, working with actors such as Stephen Burkhoff is part of the journey of actually learning how to give good notes, how to direct well. Because I think if you can take on people like Stephen Burkhoff and get them on your side and get the performance that you want, there is an art form in that. Mm. And I really appreciated, in a slightly masochistic way, working with people like that, particularly when they were in that sort of mood, because, you know, you wanted to kind of get what you needed before they blew up.
Well, I was lucky with Burkhoff that day because I'd met him, and it was only about 3 months before, and I said, you've got a Volkswagen Beetle, haven't you? And he said, yes. I said, you stopped me in Hampstead Garden suburb, and I was on my push bike, and asked me the way to this road. And that sort of softened him immediately.
Brilliant.
He said, oh, it was you. I said, yes, it just so happened to be. It's little things like that.
Little psychological game.
Yeah, that makes a session much easier than it otherwise might have been. So, you know, coming up to the present day, nothing stays the same forever. Angel Sound is no more. Tell us about that, because that came as a bit of a shock to me and to all of us. My own view, I'll post that thing on Campaign, is that it's tough times, but it certainly wasn't helped by agencies, ad agencies, opening their own in-house studios, vastly inferior to Angel and to Wave, where we are now, and then forcing their producers to go there to try and make them.
I think there are many reasons. There have been a lot of changes in the industry. I've seen it all, Paul. You know, I started at Molinaire September 1975, and I've been through recessions and huge change. I think there's many challenges that as an independent audio post-production company we were facing. You've already mentioned agencies and the in-house facilities. Clearly, you know, that was one part of it. There are other factors as well, not least of which that the cost of the premises that we occupied just seemed to be going up and up and up.
Yeah, when you
business
were there,
rates were ridiculous, and it was a horrible moment. We were in our 40th year. I still had a lot of energy and love for the business.
Mm.
And it was the most painful decision to have to take, but I had to take it. And, you know, I did it in a way that I hoped I could still hold my head up high. And yes, and here I am now. I was in a bit of a state of depression for a while,
You were remarkably cheerful. I came to see Nick shortly after it happened, and we discussed it. Unless he was putting it on, but it can't have been horrible.
No, it was a horrible thing, and I was in this weird kind of bubble. And the fact remained that it was a decision that was the right decision in the end. It had to be done. And you know, in a way, that's life. And I have to kind of look forward, not backwards now. And I'm glad to be, you know, I'm doing some radio production work now in a freelance capacity and enjoying that very much. And there's some other projects.
Book him. It's better than me.
What is your writing skills, Paul? And some other sort of projects in the pipeline. But it's been an absolute honor and a privilege to have worked with, course, the likes of you, Paul, but, you know, some unbelievable creative talent around the globe that I've learnt so much from, and I've really enjoyed the company of, and also, you know, the magnificent TV departments.
Lovely people.
Oh,
lovely
God, people. You know, producers and PAs and the people that I engaged with all the time.
I mean, I'd, like you, I don't want to die, but if it all ended like run over by a bus tomorrow, God, it's good, wouldn't it? and you just have to keep going in a different way. I mean, I've said it before, we're particularly now that you're out by yourself, like the rest of us, what we call the Soho soloists. We're a small community, you, me, Dave, all of us, and we have to look after each other. And we'll always do that. And in a funny way, I like it even more that I'm not working for a big... There are times when I wish I was.
But then, of course.
But then I think there's a time... I think I wish I was working at BNP in 1998. I don't really mean I'd like to work in a big agency now. I'm not sure.
But, well, it's just changed. It's a different kind of landscape.
It's somebody else's turn in that respect.
I could reel off a list. Yeah, I mean, there's words that I've grown to loathe, like uncertainty and globalization, procurement, etc. But I mean, you know, it's pointless me kind of going on about all of that because, you know, what happened, and
I've learned,
you know,
now it's
sort
that
of
old saying
side.
That you rather than getting unhappy about something that is no longer, be happy that it happened at all. It happened for us for years and years, and it's still happening. You know, it's just
true.
A nice radio recently, but it's just a different landscape. And that other thing, cliches are cliches because they're true, and nothing stays the same forever.
And Paul, I mean, you and I talked a bit before you wrote the article for Campaign, and obviously that got a fantastic kind of response, and because you, that part of it, you know, you hit the nail on the head and really expressed, you know, a lot of points that a lot of the independent community could relate to, and that's important because the talent in the sort of independent community and certainly in the audio post-production companies, of which, you know, I'll always fly the flag for them, is enormous. And
just the investment they've put in, that you put in, and we're sitting here in Wave, Johnny and Warren and you went and got a building and equipped it with this wonderful, you know, I wouldn't have the guts to do that. Just the word premises. But I, in a funny sort of way, I think if you are creative, the freelance position is the natural position to be in. You know, if you speak to an actor or the people we know or a playwright or something, they say, sorry, you're yoked to one employer, WPP, really? You know, we're sort of supposed to work for ourselves, and it is quite nice.
Well, that's what I'm doing now, and hopefully, you know, putting some of the years and years that I've learnt, all the stuff that I've learnt to good use. So, yes, I'll see all of you guys
seriously,
out there soon.
Everybody loves you. Nobody more than me. So I'm really not worried about you. You'll be fine.
Thank you, Paul.